Western Scotland will start off cool but bright with some sunshine. However, the sunshine slowly diminishing through the day as the cloud increases. It will stay wet across eastern and central Scotland through the day and feeling chilly with temperatures between 10 to 12 in the east, 15 Celsius in the west and southwest of Scotland. Diana.
Thank you. Now on BBC Radio 4, we begin a new book of the week. A mix of travel writing, history and horticulture. The Land Where Lemons Grow by Helena Attlee explores the Italian love affair with citrus fruit. The reader is Francesca Diamond.
I remember when planes were so expensive that people usually made the long journey from England to Italy by ferry and train. Once you got to Paris, it was easy because you could catch a sleeper that sped you through the night towards Florence and Rome. I first made that journey over 35 years ago. At dawn, I lifted the corner of the curtain in the stuffy couchette and realised we'd already crossed the border. We were somewhere on the Italian Riviera, and there were lemons growing beside the station platform, their dark leaves and bright fruit set against a backdrop of nothing but sea. I didn't know it then, but travellers from Northern Europe have always been thrilled by the sight of Italian citrus trees, and as my Italian improved, I began to realise that the trees and their fruit had a special place in the Italian imagination. I began to scrutinise the citrus trees in every garden I visited, as carefully as pictures in an exhibition. Some seemed capable of bearing two or even three kinds of fruit at the same time, and the fruit came in an extraordinary variety of sizes, shapes, and colours. The oddest and most arresting were made like yellow hands, with an unsettling number of shiny fingers that were sometimes clasped together, as if in prayer, and sometimes splayed, like a beggar's hand with spiders instead of coins nestling in its palm. Others had rotund bodies attached to protuberances like long, quizzical noses, so they resembled a cluster of watchful creatures on the branch of the tree. "A lemon is like a man when it's ill," said Silvano Mazzetti, a gardener who had long since retired but seemed unable to stop coming in to work every day at Villa Poggio Torselli in Tuscany. "The iller it is, the pricklier it gets. Just like a man who gives up shaving because he feels poorly." I discovered that many of the trees producing these strange fruits with bizarre shapes, ribbed or pitted skins, warts and carbuncles, were the fragments of great citrus collections that had belonged to the richest and most important families of the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries. The villa and palace gardens that housed Italy's citrus collections were outdoor extensions of the collections of curiosities or private museums made up of objects from distant places and times that were assembled by educated, affluent or aristocratic gentlemen all over Europe. During spring and summer, citrus trees lined the paths and steps of the garden and were arranged in groups around fountains and statues. In winter, their pots huddled in the shelter of the limonaia, or lemon house. Such close proximity allowed them to cross-pollinate freely, so that each collection continued to grow in size and diversity. They evolved, like a series of ancient and incestuous families inhabiting the walled gardens of villas and palaces all over Italy, where they existed like members of enclosed communities, outliving countless generations of aristocratic owners and expert gardeners. Originally, citrus was a very compact clan, a small and widely scattered genus made up of only the mandarin, native to China, the pomelo that grew in Malaysia and the Malay archipelago, and the citron growing on the slopes of the Himalayas in northern India. Wherever these three ancestral trees were brought into contact with each other by human migration or trade, they cross-pollinated. Most plants can only cross-pollinate successfully with other plants of their own species, but citrus is unusual because cross-pollination between different species is generally successful and produces viable seed. Many of the familiar fruits cultivated today are the hybrid progeny of spontaneous cross-pollination between wild or cultivated citrus trees. For example, Oranges, both sweet and sour, are hybrids between mandarin and pomelo. Grapefruit is the result of a pomelo-orange cross, and the lemon is a hybrid between citron and sour orange. Over the centuries, hybridisation and mutation have been the source of an ever-expanding number of varieties of common domestic citrus fruit. The orange alone accounts for 4,000. There were many aspects of citrus that Renaissance botanists and citrus collectors did not understand. Sudden changes in temperature, periods of drought, unusually high rainfall, or even wind could trigger mutation. This often affects only one or two branches of a tree, which flower at a slightly different time, produce fruit that matures at a different rate, or is even an entirely different shape and colour from the fruit on the rest of the tree. When this happened to a tree in a citrus collection, it was a wonderful mystery, and it made citrus an even more fascinating and desirable collector's item. In the 1640s, Giovanni Battista Ferrari, a Jesuit priest and professor of Hebrew at the Jesuit seminary in Rome, divided citrus into three rigid categories: citrons, lemons, and oranges. He was fearless about classifying the hybrid forms and created a whole category for monstrous fruit, which he gave the charming title of frutte che scherzano, or joking fruit. His nomenclature system was highly descriptive and almost painfully detailed, so that names such as the distorted, digitated Adam's apple lemon became official titles that continue to be used long after Linnaeus invented his international system of plant nomenclature in 1749. Oranges, lemons, and citrons were widely used in the kitchen in the 16th and 17th centuries. Perhaps the most important collection of recipes at the time was a 900-page treatise published under the title Opera in Venice in 1570. Considered the culinary summer of its day, its author was Bartolomeo Scappi, who had worked in the households of a series of Italian cardinals before becoming private cook to Pope Pius V. One of the six books in Scappi's Opera is dedicated to the preparation of every kind of meat, including porcupine, bear, dormouse, cow's udders, calf's eyes, and stag's testicles. This was food for the elite, food designed to impress or even intimidate the guests gathered around the table. As a modern reader, one is immediately struck by the ubiquitous presence of sour oranges among these recipes. The sour orange was the first kind of orange to arrive in Italy. For 200 years at least, the unique, earthy and aromatic taste of sour orange juice was as essential to an Italian banquet as ketchup is to fast food. Scappi might mix sour orange juice with oil for steaming truffles, or stir it into the rich juices in a roasting pan and combine it with a little grape must syrup, vinegar, and a clove of garlic to make gravy. He often sprinkled sour orange juice over a dish at the end of its long and complex preparation. The subjective nature of taste has made it very difficult to know when the first sweet orange reached Italy. The Portuguese are generally credited with bringing the first truly sweet oranges back from India when Vasco da Gama discovered the sea route around the Cape of Good Hope in 1498. And for the next 400 years, oranges were known all over Italy as Portogalli and Portugals in every other European language. Nevertheless, when Father Alvaro Semedo, head of the Jesuit order in China, wrote a letter in 1640 about oranges in Canton, there could be no doubt that they were infinitely superior to the Indian oranges already familiar in Europe. In Semedo's opinion, the oranges of Canton might well be queens over our own. In fact, some people hold that they are not so much oranges as Muscat grapes disguised. The decline of the sour orange as a culinary ingredient had begun, but the tree had a different future. It is a tall and vigorous specimen, a lovely tree with dark leaves that act as a foil to fruit of a deeper, darker colour than most other oranges. Sour orange trees are robust by nature. They have a strong root system. They adapt readily to a range of different soils and tolerate neglect. They are disease-resistant, can survive 8 degrees of frost for short periods, and, given ideal conditions, they can live for 6 centuries or more. Ever since the 19th century, these characteristics have made sour orange popular, both as an ornamental tree and as a choice of rootstock for more fragile varieties of citrus. Disturb the soil below a sweet orange, a lemon, or mandarin, and you'll often notice the air beneath the tree filling suddenly with the aromatic and very specific scent of sour oranges. I once arrived at dusk in Sorrento, on the steep shores of the Gulf of Naples. It was December, and the trees in the piazza were strung with Christmas lights. At first, I thought I saw golden decorations among their branches. Then I realised they were the enormous, rough-skinned lemon-citron hybrids that grow on the coasts of Campania. Sorrento and Amalfi lemons are the most famous local fruits grown in a very specific, limited area along the coast of the Bay of Salerno to either side of Amalfi. They are the main ingredients in myriad local recipes that depend on their wonderful and very specific qualities and are almost unknown outside a restricted local area. A summer pasta dish can be made by dressing spaghetti with raw garlic, parsley, and the mild but intensely flavoured juice of a Sorrento lemon. And in Amalfi, a slice of lemon sprinkled with ground coffee and sugar serves as a simple digestivo after a meal. Growing Amalfi lemons has always been a labour-intensive business. Trees must be grown on broad terraces inside a supportive scaffolding of slender chestnut posts. Towering sheaves of chestnut poles can always be seen piled beside the mountain road high about the town. Stone for building the retaining walls of terraces, manure, and even topsoil have to be laboriously carried up the hillsides from the valley floor. At harvest time, sacks of lemons weighing 57 kilos each must be carried down the hill. Tending to the trees is a job for a gymnast happy to clamber about on the terraces and negotiate steep flights of narrow steps while carrying heavy equipment. The main street in Amalfi leads out of town to the entrance of the Valle dei Mulini, where the steep slopes are clothed in vineyards and lemon terraces. Today, the sides of the valley are an intricate mosaic of brown and green. There is still more green than brown, but each brown patch contains an empty house and an abandoned lemon garden, the dead trees baked crisp by drought and years of relentless sunshine. Some families refuse to be pessimistic about the future of lemon farming. They have joined forces to set up the Cooperativa Amalfitana Trasformazione Agrumi, a farmers' cooperative focused on protecting cultivation and bringing young people back into the business. Marco Aceto, a founder member of the cooperative, offers tours of the enclosed ancient world of his family's lemon gardens, where narrow stone steps link the terraces and grass grows lush in the velvet shade of the trees. When the tour is over, Marco's mother suddenly appears beneath the trees to offer us thick slices of lemon cake, sweet lemon salad, and tiny glasses of homemade limoncello that we raise to the future of the Sfusato Amalfitano. Citrus has always been a migrant, and although it has moved on to bless other places with wealth from its golden fruit, nothing can rob Italy of its legacy. Its myriad flavours are integral to Italian food, and the scent of zagara, citrus blossom, will always linger on the air of the Mezzogiorno.
Francesca Diamond was reading The Land Where Lemons Grow by Helena Attlee. It was abridged by Lawrence Waring and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Tomorrow, at the same time, Sicily, the Mafia, and blood oranges. Now, to take us to the salt sea air of the shipping forecast, here's Sailing By. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 22nd of April. The general synopsis at 1800. High Norwegian Sea, 1026, slow moving, intensifying 1034 by 1800 Tuesday. Lows, Southwest Shannon, 999, and Belgium, 1003, both losing their identities. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s Cromarty, 4th, northeasterly, veering easterly or southeasterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6, mainly fair, then rain or showers, moderate or good. Tyne, Dogger, northeast 5 or 6, veering southeast 4 or 5, rain or showers, fog patches later, moderate or good, occasionally very poor later. Fisher, northeasterly, veering easterly 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in northeast, rain or showers,